This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the National Museum of Australia. My name's Alexandra Kidd, and I'm the Adult Programs Officer with the Museum, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome you to Daughter Store today. The Daughter Store series, for those of you that are new, is an ongoing series that aims to look at what the museum does behind the scenes and try and give you some practical tips of what you can do at home. And for the rest of you, welcome back. Today we're talking about photography, which you will well know. But before we get into it, I just wanted to let you all know, if you haven't seen the great big cameras around me, that we are recording today, and your attendance here today is considered consent to be recorded. We do these recordings, just so you know, so that people that couldn't come to the museum today or that can't actually come to Canberra do still have access to these workshops and other seminars that we put on. I'll also ask you to take this time to turn off your mobile phones or put them onto silent. And if you have a camera on your phone, I'd also encourage you to take some photos and think about where those photos are going to end up in time. You could also send them through to our Facebook if you want. Today on our panel, we have Michelle Hetherington, who's from our curatorial team, and we'll be discussing the significance of photographs. And then from photography, we've got the museum's two photographers here today, Jason McCarthy and George Saris, talking to you. And from conservation, we have Karen Wagg, who'll be talking a bit about how to look after these things at home. And then last but certainly not least, we have Lisa O'Brien, who looks after the digitisation of our collections, and will be giving you a demonstration on the importance of digitisation and looking after your photos. I'll hand over to Michelle, but I hope you all enjoy. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. How lovely to see you all here today. Now, here we go. Okay, so The most recent exhibition I've just completed is the 1913 exhibition that's on downstairs, Glorious Days, Australia, 1913. And that's an exhibition that has relied heavily on photography. Of course, 1913 is a time when photography is becoming increasingly democratic as a medium in Australia. The Kodak camera, as it was advertised, allowed people to click and forget. You no longer needed to worry about glass plates, or you didn't need to understand about chemistry. You could just send off your negatives and they would be fixed and returned to you. So photography is actually moving into a much wider part of the community, which means that the images that we had available to us were diverse and fantastic. Now, the ways that we used photography in 1913 are many, and at this point, I need to make the point of some things in exhibitions we consider to be objects and some things we consider to be graphics. And photographs can be both. But we used photographs as objects, that is, you know, the object itself, within the exhibition, particularly in the salon section. What you can see up here is a portrait by May and Minna Moore of Borneo Gardner, and he was a visiting performer. They, in fact, took photographs of many of the visiting performers in Australia, including the fantastic Ring Cycle opera performers. Now, we also have other, you know, studio photography is changing in 1913. No longer are people, well, I mean, most of the modern ones are much more focusing on the psychology of the individual. They use dramatic lighting and a minimum of props. So, wonderful. This is called dejection. Okay. And here we have Delilah. Sorry. We also have a number of other fine art photographers. And so there are works by people like Rudolf Buchner, who took this beautiful image of Louise Lovely, Australia's first international movie star. Frank Hurley, Alice Mills, Harold Casno, and John Kaufman. Now, we also used photographs to help us in our research and to ensure that there was accuracy in the exhibition's look and feel. How were hats worn? What did people actually wear? We have a model of a workman. We obviously, workmen's clothes are worn out from 1913. They had just been worn and worn and then probably torn up as rags to clean the shoes. So we had to recreate that particular outfit. What were people wearing? We looked at the photographs, and that was really, really helpful. So the images that I'm showing you, this one is an image of a woman called Nellie Donegan, and you'll be very familiar with her if you've seen anything about the exhibition. We used exhibitions in the photographs in the exhibitions as graphics. So this is where we reproduce the photograph. We don't pretend it's a real object. We're just using it as an illustrative object, illustrative material. And so that helps the audience interpret the objects that we put on display. Now, in the case of Nellie, we have a set of 1913 roller skates, and Nellie is wearing 1913 roller skates. What you probably can't see in the photograph, but you can see on the object, are that the wheels are made of wood. So, you know, quite extraordinary skill required to actually do anything on them, I would think. We also have images. Sort of just keep going until I find one of them. Here are some more of the beautiful portraits. All right. We also have images of the coronation suffrage march. Now, the objects that we have that relate to that are much more easy to understand, much more easily understood in their context when you see the photographs. And the last photograph I'll show you is from that particular march. We used photographs to document the objects in our collection, and this is where George and Jason in particular are amazing, because they can take the objects from our collection, photograph them, make them look so beautiful, but they can also discover aspects of those objects that we can't see with the naked eye, that we will miss. And so these beautiful photographs can then be used on the website, they can be used in advertising and the media, and we always love it when something from our collection can go in an exhibition, because we know it will get the George and Jason treatment. Okay. Now, how else? We used the in-house photography by our own staff for the website, as I mentioned, for the advertisements, for illustrations, for the articles that I've written, Andrew's written, other curators on the project have written. So that allows us to take the exhibition to a broader audience. And also it allows us to engage the media, get them interested in the exhibition, make them want to know what we've got to say. I did a radio interview yesterday, and trying to talk about a photograph or an object on radio is a sort of bizarre process. So normally what they ask us for is a lovely image that they can now put up on the website. So if people who enjoyed the radio program can go back and look at the image. Just keep going here. This is an art photograph by Kaufman. Ah, fantastic. Aren't they beautiful? These are vaudeville dancers, and vaudeville in 1913 was just the best thing. People loved going to it. A lot of enjoyment of theatre, music, vaudeville, cinema. Okay. Photography was also used to illustrate our fantastic book. There's a book of the same title as the exhibition, Glorious Days, Australia 1913, and the use of photography has made that book particularly lovely. You know, it makes the pleasure of reading the essays even greater. Okay. This is something about the look and feel. It has such a sort of a wonderful sense of the past. This is one of the photographs that we used as a graphic in the exhibition. When it was pushed up to a really high resolution, which is what you can do, we noticed that one of the pugilists is an Indigenous man. You wouldn't spot it unless you had a photograph that you could really look at closely. And here we go. This is a photograph of one of the first graduands from the University of Western Australia. This is the last one. These are the women from the march that I was telling you about, and they include the wife of the Prime Minister, the wife of the New South Wales Premier, the wife of the former Prime Minister of New Zealand. They're very powerful women, and it's a stereoscope. And the last thing that photography allows us to do is to document the exhibition itself. the processes by which we put it together, the way it looked when it went up, the sorts of programs that we have done associated with it. So it allows the exhibition itself to become an historical document. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle. Welcome, everyone. The photography team consists of three staff, myself, Jason McCarthy, and Katie Shanahan, and between us we service the requirements of the museum, the curatorial needs, publications, gallery documentation, collection documentation, and so on. So we're very fortunate because we have a very diverse job, that, and every moment is you know very stimulating for us. This is a shot of our studio, and we use a variety of cameras. One is a large format digital capture camera, triggered by a computer, in this case a Macintosh, and we also have 35mm digital SLRs, mainly Canon cameras, for public relations and small macro photography or other types of capturing. Here's an example of Jason McCarthy, who's actually photographing the Johnny Warren, that's right, Johnny Warren, which I think consisted of 1,510 images, according to Jason. So we used a 35mm digital camera to capture each page of this, Johnny Warren being a very famous soccer player. Our photographic archive is located within our general store, and we use Orbox in this case and other archival boxes to store our photographs, negatives, and other digital, or actually, you know, analog material such as photographic prints. Just touching on what we do, we document activities. This is open day of the museum in 2001, March the 11th. So our photography is used for numerous usages. This was for an exhibition within the Gallery of First Australians. These images that we are viewing at the moment, these are part of our landmark exhibition, which fed into digital, print, and graphic panels, so multiple usages. Once again, continuing with landmarks. So, I mean, you can see there is occasionally a bit of location work involved. And a lot of the work is also digitising our collection in 2D format, which Jason will touch upon shortly. The scale of our collection is very, very broad, from small love tokens, and you can see these in our our gallery, Australian Journeys, to larger objects as can be found within our 1913 exhibition, and various materials of textiles and other items. This is just a little snapshot of collection material that has gone into 1913. So you can actually go and see these objects later on if you wish. This is our lovely Citroën, which is located in the main hall. And we're just touching on larger objects. So we're faced to encounter scale issues and how we approach them. And in this case, we had to use available light in the car park of one of our repositories, but try to give it a bit of an atmosphere, do's and how we approach them. And in this case, we had to use available light in the car park of one of our repositories, but try to give it a bit of an atmosphere to capture the object in the best possible way. This is the Abbott coach, which is in the 1913 exhibition again, and just using available light with some additional lighting so to capture things. What I want to do is touch on our collection, which is our National Historic Collection, and our photographic material that we have within the collection. And we have examples of this, which we can have a look at towards the end. There's also some non-collection material over here, which the public can handle. This is material that either myself or Karen have brought in. But just touching on the daguerreotype, it was the first commercial successful photographic process invented around 1837 by Louis-Jacques Daguerre, a Frenchman. And it's a direct positive made from the camera onto a copper plate. copper being quite expensive at the time, and hence, the unavailability to the masses when it came to photography and portrait people or people who were photographed. So it was usually the well-to-do that had the opportunity to be photographed. And this is from our Springfield collection. We have a lot of material in our collection from Springfield, which is a property just south of Goulburn, 12 kilometres south. That collection allowed us to, use it in many, many ways. So the material, it's a mirror-like finish. It's very, very fragile, and the surface can be rubbed off by your finger. So hence it's usually protected in a velvet plush case. This is an Ambro type. The Ambro type is another material which is, it's rather than being photographed or the emulsion being placed on metal, it's on glass, which started to make it more affordable. And it's a once off the camera, so one image onto a plate per capture. And it's backed by either paint, cloth or paper to give it the reflectiveness that it needed. And it didn't have quite the tonal range, and it was less impressive than the daguerreotype. We have glass plates in our collection. In this case, and you can see about six of these. I think six of them are in our Australian Journey Gallery. So this is Daintree, Richmond. Is it Richmond Daintree? It's Richmond Daintree. That's right. Yes, Daintree collection. So this is a wet process or collodial process. He was in mainly in northern Queensland, coating his glass plates, his negatives, and these are the positives that we have from that collection. Very beautiful. They're like large format transparencies, just beautiful objects, and I hope you get to enjoy to see them. And it was obviously documenting the gold fields and other activities in Queensland. Very important collection. Here we have a tin type, which in fact is not made of tin, but it's a metal base. It's a direct positive onto a material and blackened by paint or lacquering and enamelling to give you the impression of a positive, but or depending on the angle, can also look, it's thought as a negative. And photographers usually worked around fairs, carnivals, and other areas. This started to make photography more accessible to the public, as Michelle mentioned, the turn of the century, 1900s, 12th to the 1910s and 20s. So they were very popular with street photographers, and because they were able to produce cheap images to the public. So what I'd like to do, though, is just show you an example, because it's surprisingly quite small in its size, and it's sometimes important to have a clear idea of scale. It is like a postage stamp, like Michelle said. So scale is, something to, appreciate. And at the end, we can have a look at some of the glass plates, which are much larger as well. So with the development of photography, we then moved on to the glass plate, as it was touched on before. But glass plate was a very stable medium. It was a flat plane. Optics didn't perform as well, so any element that assisted the focal plane to remain sharp was highly regarded, and glass was one of the common materials that were used at the time. So we've got collection material from the Bassetto collection around 1910, 1907. And we also have lantern slides. What lantern slides are, it's a positive which was then sandwiched in between another piece of glass to protect it. So this is the beginning of slide photography in a way for projection. So these, these plates were produced, quite often, mass produced, and slide kits were made available. These original glass plates, or lantern slides, sort of originate around the 1700s. But this photographic contemporary form is sort of peaked around, late 1800s to 1920s, and even people like Val Morgan were using glass plates 6x6 centimeters in cinemas for projection of advertising. So they certainly out, you know, they certainly live beyond the developments of other forms. And because they're relatively easy to produce, they're used by schools and universities for presentations, you know, the digital version of what this one here, I mean, we're presenting a digital version of the original glass plate lantern slide presentation. To animate things, because photography, colour didn't come in until the autochrome of around 1903, 1905, which was in fact potato starch, three colours sprinkled on a glass plate, and each potato starch colouring was photographed through a particular filter, and the culmination of those three produced colour. So this is an example of hand tinting. It's still a glass, it's a glass plate lamp, which has become a lantern slide with hand tinting to animate it. And as you can see, the beautiful detail of these, where, you know, these would have been placed in a larger projector, and you can see the sequencing of the storytelling. We have also very large films. This is a large nitrate film that was asked for us to be photographed many, many years ago, and it's stored in the freezer. You can see the dimensions. It's 1.36 metres long by 3.375. So quite a lengthy panorama of Mount Kosciuszko by Carey, the photographer, was in 1911, I believe, and we created a positive of that. We have albumen prints. So albumen used egg as a binding agent for the gelatin. We have an example of one over here that we can have a look at afterwards. So this was the beginning process of printing out negatives onto photographic paper. We did have some support material in our collection, which was nitrate-based film. Now, this nitrate film, although it's relatively stable, it can be quite volatile and can explode in ideal conditions and can continue to burn even underwater. This material was used to support our National Historic Collection and wasn't quite part of our collection. So what we did was photograph this material to create a positive, but the original films then went to the National Film and Sound Archive shoots, which is opposite us at Mitchell, for storage, and a positive was created for future usage. And hopefully we don't need to revisit that nitrate emulsion. And we have obviously contemporary films. This is from the John Lewis collection, a significant collection that consists of just over 200 portraits that he did during the 1980s. Brett Whiteley and Ita Buttrose there, famous people. And this is basically the traditional bromide silver-based emulsion placed on a variety of photographic surfaces to give us our contemporary paper that have been used for maybe the last 110 years or so. So it's a quick snapshot of the photographic process and looking in particular at our collection. And there will be opportunities, hopefully, for you to then have examine these further into the galleries. And the handout that we have sort of indicates where these items are located. So I'd like to hand over to Jason McCarthy now.
Hello, welcome, everyone. I'll be talking on the digitalisation of photographic material, which is essentially the conversion of original or analogue photographic material into electronic form or a digital format through the use of a digital capture device. As George touched on, one of the roles of the photographic unit here at the museum is to digitise a lot of this material that we have examples of in front. And I'm just going to, throughout my talk, I'll describe the processes that we use in order to digitise that material. So why do we digitise photographic material that we have in the collection? Well, there's a number of reasons, really, which I'll quickly go through. We can increase the accessibility of that material. Rather than just having a select few view the original, we can deliver it to a much broader audience through web-based programs or through publications or through advertising. We have community outreach programs as well. So a lot of this material can actually be collated and sent to remote areas of Australia. We have the preservation issue as well. By creating a very accurate digital copy of the original, we can offset the need to retrieve that original material from storage, from the stable environment of storage, thereby risking damage or deterioration to that original. We have the abilities to reproduce, again, very, very accurate reproductions of this material if need be, or for graphic panels, as Michelle touched on, for the various uses. We have a conservation aspect where a very accurate digital copy can be produced and compared to the original incrementally to see the rate of deterioration of that material. And in some rare cases, we use the digital capture, that digital copy, to replace the original. There may be the rate of deterioration may be so bad that the original is just going to fall apart in the foreseeable future. Or it might be because of the instability of the material, such as nitrate, cellulose nitrate films, which a decision might be made to digitise it and then dispose of the original or to send it off to a storage facility elsewhere. Now, the policy in terms of digitisation of photographic material here at the museum is to be as faithful to the original as possible. We want to be as accurate in terms of colour, tone and contrast, and certainly not mislead the viewer into thinking the original is something that it's not. So by saying that, we don't embellish, we don't enhance, or we don't make any changes to that original in digital form. What you see is what you get. So it's a very very objective approach rather than a subjective approach. The types of photographic materials that we are called upon to digitise generally fall into two categories. We have reflective material and we have transmitted material. Reflective material is photographic material that requires light falling upon it or being reflected from it in order to reveal the images that it holds. So prints are the main example of reflective material. Transmitted photographic material is material that requires light to be transmitted through it in order to reveal the images that it holds. So a film negative is an example of transmitted material. Digitising reflective photographic material, here we are, as I touched before, generally prints. They come in all shapes and sizes. They reflect many different photographic processes throughout time. And they can come on a number of different substrates, paper being the most common, but they can also appear on glass, on sheet metal, such as silver or copper, and plastics, polyester. This is a quick snap of our reprographic setup in our studio at Mitchell Repository. Just before I go through this, there are two avenues that we can take in terms of digitising photographic material in terms of hardware or the equipment used. One being a scanner or in its various forms, and the other being a digital camera system. Now, at the museum, we've opted for a digital camera system because we just find that far more versatile. It's very, very accurate. We're able to achieve very accurate renditions of the original. But it's also adaptable as well, depending on the nature of the object. And also, we can travel. We can tear down the setup and take it onto location as well and achieve very, very accurate results. It's also much gentler on the object as well. Scanning hardware can be a little bit rough with some of the more sensitive material that we have to digitise. So using a camera system is far gentler, and there's much less risk of damaging that material. I'll just take you just through this setup here. And as I said, this is a classic reprographic setup we would use for all our reflective material. It's not only photographic material, we also digitise artworks and handwritten documents and things of that nature. But here we have a reprographic table, which is fully adjustable. So it's quite a bespoke table, so it's a very, very versatile piece of equipment. We have our camera system here. So that's a high-end digital SLR system, full frame. We use prime lenses because of their high standard of optical quality. We have that mounted above and parallel to the surface here. So again, that's adjustable, so they can go up and down and out and in, depending, again, on the nature of the material being digitised. We have a symmetrical lighting system supplied here by studio flash units, and they're driven by studio packs. Very, very powerful lights. They allow us an incredible range of adjustment as well, very, very fine adjustment, so we can really, really peg exposures to very fine levels. Attached to those, we have light diffusers, soft boxes here, which diffuse the light and give us a very even spread of light on the surface, which for doing any reprography, any digital digitization of flat media, it's essential that we have even illumination across that area. We choose flash, even though we can use constant light source for this sort of reprography. We choose flash because, again, it's just far more versatile, very adaptable. We can move the lights in and out depending on the spread of the light that we need, and it's actually much gentler than the objects as well. The flash is so brief that there's no risk of any light fading occurring on the objects themselves. The system is run by a laptop computer, so we've linked that up to a cable to the camera, so we fire the camera remotely from the laptop. And at the heart of the laptop, we run a specialised capture software, raw capture and processing software, called Capture One. This whole system is a colour-managed workflow, which means that because of the level of accuracy that we must get, colour accuracy is paramount. We've got to capture that colour exactly. And we do so by using custom colour profiles of the camera here. The camera has a digital sensor, and it has its own way of understanding colour and recording colour. And they're generally very, very good, but if you compare one camera to the next, there's slight variances. And when we're called upon to do this colour critical work, those variances just are unacceptable. So what you use is a Greta Macbeth colour checker here. That's a chart. There we go there. That's our chart. We have an example down there. 140 colour swatches taken from the known colour space. Now, this is an industry standard chart. And for each one of those colours, we have known coordinates. We have a mathematical RGB values that we're able to plot those colours exactly. So what we do, we have the camera take a photograph of that chart. With profiling software, we see how the camera understands those colours, and we see those variances from the known values that we know to the way that the camera is recording those. And that creates a number of instructions or a series of instructions, and that gets locked into what we call a custom camera profile. So we now know that when we take a photograph with that particular camera, if we apply that profile, those colours will lock straight in. Here we have a screen grab just of the software that we run. And we've got a period photograph that we've shot there. We would have established our exposure values, again, just off the colour chart there, the white, black and grey values. Once we have our exposure locked in, we apply the colour profile from that camera, and the colours just snap straight in. And in photographic terms, it's actually very exciting to see. Here's our finished product. Now, that's exported as a TIFF, a very stable digital format. We also append metadata, information into the actual file itself, things about the object, and some copyright information concerning the National Museum. You'll notice that this particular photograph has been dry-mounted to a piece of card, and we've actually photographed the entire card. That's because we're treating this photograph as an object rather than just the image that the photograph holds. And that means recording everything about it. In this case, the dry-mounted card that it's placed upon. Here's a photograph of Dr. Bell of Campbelltown. So how do we know it's Dr. Bell? Well, it's written on the back. But this is an example of how thoroughly we document this image. A photograph is more than just the image itself. It's the sum total of all its parts. So there's information on the back that's pertinent to this photograph as well. And also the photographic process of the time and the technology of the time. These are all clues that give us an understanding or the story about the photograph. So we try and include as much as we can, and we try and be as accurate as we can with this digitisation. Another example, this time we've got another hand annotation on the back and a date. Now, moving on to transmitted photographic material. This essentially is as I said before, material that requires light passing through it in order to reveal its imagery. So this could be black and white negatives, it can be glass plate negatives, it can be lantern slides, and it can be colour transparencies. We use a very similar process for transmitted digital capture than we do with reflected, except it's a bit upside down. Here we have our table, but this time we have a flash unit mounted in the centre of that table, and it fires the light through it. We have a camera mounted above. We mask off the negative that we're going to photograph. Now we have that negative placed emulsion side up. And it's much the same as you would in the darkroom. You always print emulsion to emulsion. we'll virtually just sort of turn that upside down. We do that because it's the most detailed view we're going to have of that detail. Rather than trying to photograph through the clear carrier or the carrier base, we photograph right from the emulsion itself. The whole system is driven by the laptop computer again with the same software, but we have to make some variances in terms of how we capture this. Because of the nature of this transmitted material, such as negatives, if we have a particular exposure for the light source on a well-exposed and well-developed negative, if we then try and use that same light source on a very dense negative, it may not yield any results whatsoever. Or if we try to use that same light output on a very thin negative, we might just blow all the detail out. So we do have to have a bit of a floating benchmark, depending on the object itself, rather than doing a batch process. Okay, again, here's a screenshot. We've got a Stouffer colour step in theirs, which we use to neutralise. And we also can peg our white and black points with that. And so that gives us a bit of a starting point in which to digitise this material. When we output it, here it is here. We then have to laterally reverse that. Because we shot it the emulsion side up, we then have to reverse it, laterally reverse it, so as though we're looking at through the clear base. From this point on, we generally bring the image up on a colour-calibrated monitor, and we have the negative or the transmitted material on a light box that's the same lux level as the monitor that's outputting. We then have to do some fine adjustments, and unfortunately we have to treat these individually because there's just inherent characteristics within that transmitted material that we just have to fine-tune. The relationships of the tones, the characteristic curve, the contrast, and sometimes the colour as well. And from that, we have our finished, digitised transmitted material. But we have to take an extra step. And we have to understand that we are treating this as an object in its own right, so we're doing as an accurate reproduction as we can. But we always have to remember that this was intended as an intermediate step in the photographic process. It was always intended to be taken a step further to create a positive image that's easily interpreted. So this is where a little bit of subjectivity comes into it. We are actually creating that positive from it. Now, if we did just a straight flip, the tones wouldn't be quite right. So we do need to sort of invest a little bit of aesthetic into that. It's almost like creating a working print in a dark room. Here we have an example of, and this is a particularly well-exposed and well-developed negative, and here's the positive that we've created. The amount of detail that we can extract from these is extraordinary, especially of the medium and the large format negative or transmitted material that we've got. Here's another example. Again, this is absolutely beautiful to see in true life. It's just the amount of detail is so rich, it's almost like an etching. Here's an example of a particularly dense negative, and it's been underexposed, it's quite flat, it's been overexposed, and it's probably badly developed as well because there's some fogging on the film base. But when we do the positive, we try and bring that to a level that it's easily to interpret. We don't try and correct any of these flaws. We see we've lost detail here, but at least we bring it to a level in which we are able to extract the information. We don't go to any extremes. We don't get too arty with it. Again, it's just a working print that we're creating. These are examples of glass slices, particularly a thin one, and we've had some damage has occurred here somewhere along its lifetime. It could be fixed post-capture with software, but we don't touch it. This is how the original looks, and this is how we depict it. And here's another Latin slide. This had physical damage to the glass carriers. Again, this could be corrected post-capture, but this is how we wish to depict this original material. That's been a very, very quick overview of the digitization process that we carry out at the museum's photographic unit. In all honesty, we could talk about this for 3 hours and still have more to talk about, but I mean that's really just a very snapshot, a quick snapshot of how we go about digitizing this material. And it's just one of the steps, in the fabric that all of our various units give to looking after and providing access to this material to the general public. I'd just like to introduce Karen, who will be talking about the conservation approach to a lot of this material. So, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jason, and hello, everyone. My name's Karen Wagg, and I work in the Conservation Department here at the National Museum of Australia. So as a conservator, I provide care that assists in the preservation of the collection. And as you can see by listening to our previous speakers, photographs form a really important part of our collection here at the museum, but they're also an important part of many of your collections at home. So a lot of the care that we provide for the collection here are things that you can duplicate with your own collections. So it's important to understand that the deterioration and damage that occurs to photographs happens because of internal and external factors. So the internal or inherent factors relate to the makeup and consequent stability of the photographs. And these can be issues that are difficult to deal with. The external factors, though, are the conditions that our photos are subjected to, and we can control those sorts of things. So the main things to think about are the environmental conditions our photos are subjected to, our handling practices, and the types of physical storage that we use. So first, when we're talking about handling, you can see that I'm wearing plastic gloves, and wearing gloves is good practice with photographs. So if you go for plastic gloves, close-fitting, powder-free surgical gloves are a good option because you still have a bit of sensitivity of touch. You can go for cotton gloves. Although you have a little, sometimes cotton gloves can be slippery and they can catch on any damaged areas on photos. So when you're making a decision, take those sorts of things into account. Bare hands can be okay so long as they're clean, but never touch the emulsion on a photograph with your bare fingers because the oils in your fingertips can cause your fingerprints to become etched into the surface. So other aspects of good handling include preparing and planning for what you're going to do, so making sure you've got time and space to carry out what you're going to do. Provide support for objects, so whether that's support for a single photo as you're moving it, so you might like to support it in a tray or on a board when you're moving it from one spot to another. That will limit the amount of physical handling. Using a book pillow is also a good way to handle a photo album, particularly older photo albums that may be structurally delicate. You're providing proper support for that spine. Now, the type of pillows that you can use at home are, you know, just your standard sort of pillows that are, but make sure that they're not overstuffed so that you can move the stuffing in them. You could also put two small cushions inside a pillowcase and use it that way, because that way you get an indentation in the centre. Now, looking at this photograph actually brings me to looking at this here also then brings me to the idea of the types of physical enclosures you have for objects. So the types of products you want to use will generally be things that are of archival quality. And ideally, they will have passed the PAT test, which is the photographic activity test, which is conducted by the Image Permanence Institute. And these are products that have been tested for their reactivity with photographs. Now, in older albums like this, you wouldn't think about removing them, even if the materials used are not of a high quality. You might use other options, such as interleaving interleaving is a good one, but you just want to make sure that you're not going to put excess stress on the album by adding to its bulk with extra pages. Here I've got some other options for putting together your own album. So, you know, avoid sticking your pictures down onto your pages. One thing you can do is use photographic corners. Now, you can purchase photographic corners, but again, look for archival quality materials, or you can make your own. So you can make them from plastics like polyester film, or mylar as it's often called, with double-sided tape, just so long as you make sure that the tape's not going to come in contact with the photo, and sticking those down. That's a good way to mount your photos. If you use separate sheets and put them in a ring binder, then you can add pages as necessary. You can also use plastic sleeves to keep your photos in. There's a lot of products available, and you can actually do searches for conservation suppliers on the internet. But the types of plastics you want to look for are polyesters and polypropylene plastics. Here we have one of the types of albums that we use at the museum. And it's good because it has extra buffering with a case. And you can, again, add pages as required internally. You don't necessarily have to put your photos into albums. You can keep them in boxes. Again, look for archival quality materials. It's good practice to actually encase your photographs in separate enclosures. Here I have an example of a four-flap envelope. Now, these come in a number of different size formats, and you can actually get them for things like glass plate negatives. They're a great way to store that type of material because you can open them out and then not have to pull your object in and out and possibly cause damage to it that way. It's great to actually label your enclosure rather than your photograph. If you do feel that you'd like to put some information onto the photograph itself, never use biro because you'll make an indentation in the image. Label in a soft graphite pencil along a back edge of the picture. Another thing to consider is when you're displaying your photographs. So here I've got some archival quality cotton rag mount board, and we've got a support backing board and a window mat. Now, again, photo corners are a good way to mount your photos into these sorts of enclosures. If you use commercial framers, just ask them if they are familiar with conservation practices, and that's a good way to determine which ones to go with. So the other important factor, which I have to touch on, is the environmental factors. And so this is something to consider when you're displaying your pictures, because the types of environmental factors that contribute to the deterioration of photographs are things like light, relative humidity and temperature, and biological pests. So if you're going to display your pictures, it's often good to use copies or at least keep them in, put them in places in your house where you don't have a lot of light shining directly on them. What you really want to try and achieve with your environmental conditions are stability. And so this is particularly important with your relative humidity and temperature. Fluctuations in relative humidity will cause the materials in many photographs to swell and contract, which will cause damage. And as with many environmental factors, they're interrelated, and so temperature and relative humidity have a direct bearing on one another. So changes in temperature will cause changes in relative humidity. When you're thinking about where to put your storage in the house, think about areas that are in the centre of your house, as these will be more stable than areas that are, you know, the areas to avoid include roof cavities, under the floor, and against external walls. You do provide extra buffering for your materials by putting them in boxes and enclosures. I have some specific information about the types of levels of relative humidity to go for. So if anyone wants those for particular types of photographic formats, you can come up and talk to me about those after the presentation. Now, here, I think we've just got a few images as I've been going through. I know I missed the one about the bugs, but bugs, when you do see things like bugs and mould in the areas where you're storing your photographs, then that's usually letting you know that there are things that are wrong with your environmental conditions. So, for instance, mould growth generally means that you've got a relative humidity of above about 60%. So look for the cause, and that can help you to solve those sorts of problems. these photos here. So this is just an example of a photo that doesn't have one of our window mats. And when the picture, it doesn't have a sort of a buffer between it and the glazing, then when it does, when relative humidity is high, that emulsion layer can become tacky and it can actually stick to the glazing and become very difficult to remove. So if you do have problems that have occurred because of these sorts of issues, then it's a really good idea to contact a conservator. Damage is difficult to treat often, and so it is always good to find someone who is familiar with the materials. To find conservators in your area, you can actually visit the AICCM, which is the Australian Institute for the Conservation of Cultural Materials website, and there is a link to finding a conservator in private practice in your area. So I think my last image here is just some of the other damage, and just a few, you know, things to avoid include using sticky tape, to mend your photographs. And you can sort of see there's some damage caused by sticky tape on this image. The adhesives in sticky tape change over time, and from being sort of sticky and clear, they migrate into your papers and begin to change colours into these just horrible dark brown stains. So don't use sticky tape. Other things you should avoid too include PVC plastic enclosures, and you can often smell PVC. You want to avoid metal paper clips to keep groups of photos together, because those will cause physical damage, and also if the clips rust, you'll get staining and things like that as well. So there's just a few things to think about, but I'll be here if you have any specific questions. But now I'd like to hand over to Lisa.
Thank you, George. Hi. I work in registration, but I work in a slightly different area. I work managing two databases. One is a digital asset management system that we're soon to finish putting in, and it'll manage all our media assets. And then we also have a collections information database, which is KEMU, and basically we make records in EMU to record our objects. Okay, so when thinking about the work in museums, your first thoughts are probably based around visiting a museum, I would imagine. Me too. Exhibitions, interesting displays and stories. The exhibitions that stick in my mind are usually those that I emotionally connect to, or exhibits and displays that are beautiful. Displays that are beautiful require little interpretation, such as the gorgeous light box of Kimberley Points in the Gallery of First Australians. This case illustrates how mass display can work, though not all objects lend themselves to this type of display. Mostly museums just show one or two objects to represent a type of object. Doesn't mean that we don't have other objects that are very similar. Or we display a few objects that are pertinent to a story or their previous owner. For instance, Burke and Wills' water bottle is well placed to tell the story of the ill-fated Burke and Wills expedition. In modern museums, aesthetics, good taste and a good story, funnily enough, seem to be barriers to display of mass objects. I do say this with tongue-in-cheek. The reality is, however, that only 5% of our collection is on display at any one time. I did a quick calculation based on an average display time of 7 years. This is a guesstimate only. And based on this, only 70% of our collection will be displayed each 100 years. This figure, of course, does not reflect that objects on display longer than 7 years, that we may display signature or popular objects, such as Farlap's heart, more than once, or that some objects will never be appropriate for display, either because they're not curatorially interesting, or because they're not conservation-wise fit for display. Don't misunderstand me. Nothing beats the authentic experience of standing in front of a famous or beautiful object on display. The work related to exhibiting is essential to museums and exciting, but it is also costly, both in monetary terms and, as Jason touched on, in terms of the object itself. The figures that I've just given you are a good argument for more exhibition space and for open storage. But increasingly, museums and galleries and libraries are also using the virtual world as a means to allow access to our collections. I love collection search components of museum websites. For me, many of you might have been luckier, visiting the British Museum or the V&A in London is still but a dream. But I can view their collections on time, any time I like. And of course, where would we be without the NLA's historic newspapers online? Everyone caught up with those? In the library, probably, is the answer to my question. But online, they're available to you 24/7, anytime you like. As I am here to talk about collections information systems and digital asset management systems, yep, I see you yawning, I understand. You might be thinking, yep, she's an IT type person or a geek or a nerd. But like many of you, I can't be bothered programming the television or the DVD recorder. And funnily enough, when practicing this, my husband was really pleased to hear that because it means he's still got a job. Equally, the databases that I support are really not the interesting part of my work, surprisingly. What does inspire me is the important work that our databases support, the recording of objects, and that is definitely a partnership between the work of registration and the work of curatorial. And, you know, the information that they capture is vital. Information once held in digital form can be used in infinite ways with little post-production. Once a quality record and images have been taken of an object, they can literally be posted with a click of a button. In the public domain, connections can be made between objects in dispersed collections. As little as a decade ago, this would not have been possible, as museum catalogues were recorded on handwritten cards in wooden drawers. For me, collection search goes to the heart of what museums are founded on. Access to knowledge devoid of bias for gender, social standing, and the rest. In truth, our collections belong to all of you and everybody else. One of the great parts of my job is that I get to learn about collections through the collections record and images records and the images held in the two databases. You might not think that's very lucky, but I like it. This afternoon, I had hoped to show you two objects that are favourites of mine. Not that I have ever stood in front of them. These objects have never been on display except for a collection search. It would have been a sneak peek. Here on the front table is the first object that I wanted to show you, and it's just in the middle here, this one here. I'm not sure if you'll be able to get a good shot of it. Anyway, you can come up and have a good look at it later. According to the record in EMU, it is a handwritten and hand-illustrated nature study book compiled by Mary Kendall. Mary was born in 1891 in the small Victorian town of Brim and trained as a teacher. As a qualified teacher, Mary was posted to Natamuck in the Wimmera. The record says that the book was likely to have been compiled around 1911 to 1919 when Mary was in her 20s. She used it to teach her students subjects such as botany. While we have released the record to the object collection search, the content of the sketchbook, as you can see by the nice image that we have of it, has yet to be digitised. And we hope, though, that this work will be completed by the end of the year. This is a really good example of material that really lends itself to digitisation because essentially when we display something like this in the galleries, what we tend to do is open it to a page because it is a fragile item. And that page will be displayed for a number of months and then we'll flip it to another page. But essentially when we digitise something, it means that we can take an image of every single page and later this year we will do that and then post it up online so you can effectively read the book, which for me is a really exciting prospect. And, you know, when I look at that item, all I want to do is flick through it. Of course, I'm not going to because it's just not what you do with a museum object. So the second object that I had hoped to bring you was too fragile for display today, which kind of illustrates my point in a way. I would have loved to have seen this. I'm dying to see it right in front of me, but I haven't. It is, according to its title, a needlework sampler on wool and evenwear fabric featuring boats and the text Botany Bay. It was made by Margaret Begbie, a 10-year-old girl from Scotland, and it has been dated to have been made between 1790 and 1840. It depicts an image of Botany Bay, New South Wales, in the early years of settlement. The word Botany Bay appears above two sailing ships flying the English naval flag alongside two men in a rowboat, and on the wharf three figures are standing in archways. Although you cannot view this within the museum walls, it has been included in collection search for a number of years. And in fact, we also have an interactive with Zoomify for this one. I like to imagine how delighted young Margaret might have been about her work being shown around the world, way beyond her imagination, I'd imagine. I know my kids love to show off. The photography team have photographed this object, and so later this year when we update collection search, we will make more images available that are stored currently in our new dams. The museum's dams contains more than 60,000 media assets. These were previously stored, as you can see here. So this is where George and Jason saved their work to, so to speak, were stored on the museum network drives, which could only be accessed by our photography and copyright teams. You can imagine that managing these images so that the correct photograph can be found has in the past been a bit tricky. Images under our network, as you've just seen, were stored under job numbers, and a small amount of metadata has been, as Jason touched on, placed into the metadata so that we can relate, for instance, this image to its object. And so what you can see there in the metadata is the IR number for this object under title. Just keep this thought in your head, because this is a way you too can add information to your digital images. So in the case of the NMA, our dams will help us to better manage our media assets such as images and ensure that they're backed up, while also giving broader access to museum staff and soon to the public via collection search. So how do you manage your images at home? I can see you all looking a bit shocked. They say that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and I would suggest to you that this is only the case if you know who or what the picture is of, perhaps also where it was taken and maybe even why. Sorry, what you're looking at here is actually our new dams and Emma searching for those images that we just saw on that filing system. And, you know, they made me do a live presentation. And you just cross your fingers that it's all going to work. It's timed out. Emma will get the hang of it, perhaps. Anyway, so are your pictures worth 1,000? Have they got a few words with them? We did suggest writing on the back. It's probably not. It's not very, you can't do that with digital files. Anyway. Anecdotally, we know that when faced with the prospect of the house burning down, people tend to grab their family first and then the photograph album. What would you take? Not just the family photograph album, I hope. Anyway, as the museum documents collections through images, we also document our families' lives. And in many cases, we do this prolifically. Faced with the reality of a fire in my house, I would take my family first. And yes, photos. But I'll tell you, I can't see me running very fast out of the house with this. So if you think that I'm converted, there's still a bit of a way to go for me. And I'll tell you the other thing about this and why you should get things in digital form is because I'd imagine that most of these folders are not complete because I've taken stuff out of them, and always thinking that I could always get another one reprinted, couldn't I? Maybe not today. So digital form in this day and age is probably a good way to store things. So here are, as I said, it's a really guilty secret. So another thing is, I had hoped to bring with me some favourite photos taken of my grandparents in 1936. Here is the scanned version. They're the only historic photos that I have ever had scanned, and they are of high resolution. I have to say they do lack the charm of the originals, which I would have bought you if I could have found them. looking at these and other examples of family photos, which I could find, and there's a couple of them just here on this front table, you'll see this is actually the same lady that's in my grandmother. They could be anyone without a few words around them. It could be Great Aunt Mavis's brother or sister or whoever you like. So words are busy, important. What I know about these ones are that they're my grandparents before they were married in 1936. They're looking pretty relaxed and full of hope. That this photographic session would have been an event for them. They likely rode a horse from Dalton to Gunning to have these taken. I additionally know quite a bit about Olczyk, the itinerant photographer behind the camera. Olczyk used to put on limelight shows to attract customers. According to one newspaper article, he once set fire to the hall in Narrabri doing this. Not sure when he became a photographer in Australia, but he stowed away on a ship from Czechoslovakia when he was 16 and unfortunately died in Gunning of botulism shortly after these photos were taken. So I love stories like this, and you might think about what you know about your photos, and I pay attention. There's no guarantee that my children will be interested. Perhaps my grandchildren will be when I'm not around. Without the story, these images could be, as I said, anyone. I can only encourage you to add as much metadata or information to your photos as you can, when you can. Image viewer that we showed you before, which was just that little, so once you've digitised something, that little screen down below and you just pull up your page when you're in Windows 7 and you've got that, is a good place to start because you simply click into those fields and type. And that adds a bit of data to your images that will stay with them. Adding metadata will also help you find your images. Another way to document your images is to ensure that each file has a descriptive title such as Sally Blue's birthday 2013, just as an example. My next piece of advice is that you must back up your digital files. How many people keep their photos either on the camera, or on one computer, or it's really a bad idea? I would say that, you know, what you need is an external hard drive like these, easy to buy anywhere you like, and everything in that box, infinitely more portable, isn't it, could be stored on one of these. So they're a really good investment. So in addition to that, you might also store your images, or you could consider some of the variety of cloud options that are available. Does everyone know what a cloud option is? A cloud option is where you might pay, they might be free, or you might pay a little bit of money, and basically, you know, things like iCloud, which is an Apple one, or Google Images has Picasa. So these facilities are that you store your images on their storage facility, and they can either be free or they can be a small charge. So in the case of a fire, you can just run out the door. Not sure about the family. Features that I would consider important when considering cloud options is the ability to store your images at its full resolution and any opportunity offered to catalogue or arrange the images and then to share them with your family and friends, which avoids the photograph album. Many also offer opportunities to feed images directly to Facebook or other social media, if that's what you're into. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.